Welcome to the AWS Podcast. This is your regular journey into all things Amazon Web Services, including service updates, technical tips, deep dives, and interviews. Please visit aws.amazon.com/podcast for previous episodes, RSS feeds, and to share your feedback. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the AWS Podcast, episode number 85. Brilliant to have you back. My name's Simon Alicia, Principal Solution Architect located here in beautiful Melbourne, Australia. And joining me from Seattle, Washington, my brand new shiny co-host, Mr. Jeff Barr. G'day, Jeff. How are you going?
Happy to be back again.
Good to have you back for the next podcast in the series. And a lot of updates today, so we're going to kind of roll through them, and hopefully there'll be some things that are of interest and of use to you as you go ahead and listen. Now, one of the new things that has been released just recently is a new cost explorer for AWS. And this is kind of important because people, when you're operating in a pay-as-you-go, pay-as-you-use type model, it's interesting psychologically, Jeff, what I've seen is that people have a much bigger focus on what the cost for resources are than maybe in traditional environments where, you know, they didn't sign the check, they didn't see how much it cost, etc. So people not only want more information, but they want better visibility into this type of information. And I think the Cost Explorer goes a big way to doing this, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. And we built the Cost Explorer to make it easy for people to do that. We set it up so that they go into the management console, they turn on the Cost Explorer, they can see their current month's spend, and they can see their last 4 months' spend as well. And then they can actually start looking at trends. They can look at spending patterns. There are multiple views that they can look at spending either overall. They can break it down by service. If they have tagged their AWS resources, let's say they have tags for either different departments, or perhaps they have tags for development, for testing, for staging, and for production, they could break it down by those tags. If they've linked several AWS accounts together, they can, in the master account, they can manage the spending by the linked accounts as well.
Yeah, it's really quite powerful, and it gives you a nice graphical display as well. You can also export into a CSV file so you can manipulate it further. Jeff, you mentioned something really important, which is tagging. I highly recommend our listeners that they tag their resources. It helps to understand what they're for, what they're part of. You can use those tags intelligently. I have a lot of customers who'll tag particular resources to indicate whether they can be automatically turned off or not in the evenings. But obviously from a billing standpoint, it makes it super easy to do. If you're not doing chargeback to particular projects, just show back as to where your spend is going and looking at optimization opportunities. So certainly a good thing to have a look at in the new console.
Yeah, I agree. Tagging is essential. Once you get beyond having one of anything, if your memory's as bad as mine is, it's just really important to actually put a little label on there and say, this is what it is, and maybe another tag, this is what it does, and this is how important it is.
Exactly. Super important. So another thing that we try and do for our customers is, of course, listen to what they want and what they need. And in EC2 land, often customers will ask for different kinds of EC2 instances with different mixes of memory or storage or CPU capacity. And Jeff, we have a brand shiny new one that is available all over the place for our users.
That's right. We've got the memory-optimized R3 instances, and we launched those simultaneously in 7 different AWS regions. These instances range anywhere from the R3 large with 15 gigabytes of RAM all the way up to the R3.8 extra large, which is 244 gigabytes of RAM. Now, to put that into perspective, in 1977, I worked in a little computer store for the summer, and at the end of the summer, I'd saved up enough money to actually buy a 4 kilobyte memory card. And that 4 kilobytes is 1/10^8 of the size of the R3.8X large. So that's an incredible eight orders of magnitude in the course of my career.
It's amazing. It's amazing how these things change over time. And, you know, customers were demanding this kind of instance because they want to run things that are more memory intensive and want to have that space, if you like, to do manipulate things in memory. Now, the nice thing with these instances is they also have a pretty decent amount of onboard instance storage, which is in the form of solid-state disk, which is great. It uses the new Intel Xeon E5 2670V2 Ivory Bridge processors. You also notice, as a side comment, that when we talk about EC2 instances these days, we do tell you what the processor types are. We're moving away from the ECU model and giving you access to the processor types, just because it makes it easier for our customers, and that's important to us. And of course, we support hardware virtualization only on these particular instance types, because we support the enhanced networking capability, which means lower latency, lower jitter, and most importantly, a much higher packet per second performance. So a pretty important release there. Now, just related to that is something I want all of our listeners to be aware of, which is that we have, of course, a whole lot of different instance types. You know, there's the M1s, the M2s, the M3s, C1, C2, C3, the CR1s, the new R3s, the high ones, the I2s. It's a veritable alphabet soup there, but it's actually pretty easy. There are older generation instances and newer generation instances, and it's really important to focus when you're looking at your application on taking advantage of the newer generation instances wherever possible. And this is for some very good reasons. Firstly, in general, they'll be cheaper than the older generation instances and give you more performance than the older generation instances. So a super simple example, if you're using a M1 large, you're much better off using an M3 large. It'll be slightly cheaper, and from memory, it'll be about 50% faster in terms of its performance. So it's kind of a no-brainer. So one of the things a lot of customers don't do is they don't go back over time and just look at their environment and optimize for current generation performance. And the nice thing is it's so easy in EC2 to stop the instance, change the instance type, start the instance, or if you're using Autoscale, change your launch configuration, launch some new instances, and take advantage of those extra new types of instance types that are available to you. I think, Jeff, it's a bit of a habit we have, isn't it, that we set something up and we just kind of leave it and it runs fine and we don't go back to it. But there's money to be saved and there's performance to be had.
There is, and you could also make kind of a hygiene argument that it's probably better for your overall trust in your environment if you feel very, very comfortable shutting down and rebooting your instances and moving them to... If you start to think in kind of a superstitious way that it's been running for a long time and you'd better not change it, that's a bad sign. If you fully understand your system configuration, you should have a lot of confidence in the fact that you can shut down, reboot, upgrade to newer generations of instance types.
Absolutely. You're right. You want to have your environment be far more flexible because then you can take advantage of things like better performance, lower cost, and you're right. The resilience almost comes as a side benefit from that, which is fantastic.
Yeah. You know, one thing also we should remind our listeners of is the fact that when they look at clock speeds of the different generations of instance types, that probably understates the amount of performance benefit you're going to get from going from a previous generation to a current generation. In a lot of cases, you'll find that the newer generations of hardware can actually process instructions more efficiently, maybe less cycles per instruction. They've been optimized in different ways so that the clock speed isn't the only indication that the machines have become faster.
That's a very good point. And, of course, you can benchmark your applications. You can spin up one of those new instances and try it out for yourself. So probably a bit of a recommendation to grab yourself a cup of coffee. And, Jeff, I'll resist the urge to argue the benefits of Melbourne coffee versus Seattle coffee. But really, you could spend a relaxing half an hour, go through your environment, and probably improve your performance significantly and save yourself a bit of money as well, which is not a bad way to spend half an hour, I'd say.
Certainly not. And remember that with the cloud, you can always launch things on demand, use them, and shut them down. So you don't have to go to your manager, beg for funds to simply buy a new machine. You simply launch one, spend a few dollars, and try it out.
Exactly. Now, another service that we know a lot of our customers love is the Amazon Relational Database Service, and in particular, running the Oracle Database Engine. And this is, of course, a managed service that allows you to automatically deploy and use databases. In this case, we'll talk about the Oracle database. And one of the things it includes is the ability to deploy in multiple availability zones, and it'll take care of the replication for you. However, we recently announced support for a Oracle product, in particular the Oracle Golden Gate product, in concert with Amazon RDS. Now, let me ask you, Jeff, why would we need this if we already have multi-AZ replication for Oracle RDS?
So it turns out that a lot of our customers already are running Oracle on-premises, and they're looking to put together a number of different architectures where they might actually want to replicate, let's say, on-premises to an RDS DB instance. Maybe they're running Oracle already in the cloud, but they're running it on EC2 rather than in RDS, and they'd like to replicate from one of those locations to the other. They might be running RDS in several different AWS regions, and they would like to replicate on a transactional basis from region to region.
Exactly. It really does give them a lot of flexibility in terms of how they set up their topology. And often, you know, you may have legacy systems involved, you may have systems that can't be moved, but you still want to share the data around. You still need to have that coherence between your environment. And now it's possible to deploy Oracle Golden Gate with RDS, which is, I think, a big win for our customers.
It is. When people are looking to move enterprise applications into the cloud, these are the kinds of products that they look for. And when they see them up and running in the cloud, easy to launch, easy to configure, I think that should make the cloud a very welcoming environment for them.
Absolutely. Now, you spin up the Golden Gate Hub on an EC2 instance. You make sure you choose the correct size for the type of processing you're going to be doing. And there's a few other configurations you need to do. Fortunately, all listed in the Amazon RDS user guide, so just go there and kind of follow the bouncing ball, as we say. Now, another update, and the last one we'll talk about today, is for a service called Amazon CloudFront, which is our content distribution network and helps make things run faster around the world. We have over 50 different points of presence around the world, so you can cover most places in the globe. But a new capability is on the scene. It's kind of a quiet release, but it's something that's really important, I think, in terms of improving end-user experience. And this is the support for the eDNS client subnet support. Now, we're going to get a bit technical here, but let's go down there, Jeff. What's the go with eDNS, and why is it important when customers are using CloudFront?
When the client is connecting up to CloudFront, CloudFront has to decide, where should I serve up the information from? And so in the earlier days of DNS, the DNS was actually a centralized service, and so the location of the DNS server to connect it up to actually gave something of a strong hint as to the best way to resolve the query. These days, you have things like OpenDNS and Google DNS that actually have points of presence around the world themselves, and so that location isn't a strong enough hint to allow CloudFront to make a good decision. So this protocol extension to DNS was designed, called eDNS Client Subnet, and what this protocol does, it includes some additional information in the request that allows CloudFront to make a more high-quality decision about the proper edge location to use to service the query.
And that really does help, because what we're finding, it's interesting, I'll give you a little anecdote from the office here. One of my colleagues was working with a customer, and they were having exactly this problem where they were using CloudFront and they were testing the performance, and it wasn't great for them. Like, what's going on? It should be faster, it should be better. And, you know, One of the leadership principles we have here is dive deep. So we dove deep with the customer and determined that they were, in fact, using, in this case, the Google DNS. So I think it's the 8.8.8.8 address. And that was kind of messing with where CloudFront thought it should be serving from compared to where it actually should have been serving from. And it's a beautiful thing where a customer can say, look, this is really not working optimally for me. And then 2 days later, we release this capability. It's like, well, it's working now. So it's kind of like if things aren't exactly how you like them, tell us about it, and it'll get fixed and made better. So this is something that's, again, available. You don't have to do anything. It happens automatically, but it should improve general customer end-user performance around the world when using those types of geographically dispersed DNS solutions.
Simon, you bring up a really important point there that I think we should remind all of our customers of. We are very, very much customer-driven at Amazon and within the AWS team, and it's always important that we remind our customers that they can do their part. If there's something that we're doing incomplete or incorrect or inefficiently or, in your opinion, just plain wrong, please tell us about it. You reach out to us through email or through Twitter or on a forum, or write a blog post and get it voted up on Hacker News or Reddit. And you can be very, very sure that we will see it, and that the right, it will be routed to the right product manager inside the organization, and it will be used as a really good indication of what our customers are seeing in the field.
That's a very good point, and that also does extend to the podcast. So we do love to get your feedback. You can reach us at AWSpodcast@amazon.com. We like to hear about what you like, what you don't like, what you want to hear more of, etc. So please do send us your feedback. We do love to get it. And also, if you do have colleagues or friends who are interested in Amazon Web Services, please let them know that podcast exists. We've been expanding the number of podcast directories we're listed on to try and make it easier for listeners to pick it up and get it however they like. If there's things that we're not listed on that you'd like us to be listed on, let us know. We really want to know. So again, thank you so much for listening and look forward to talking to you real soon. See you later, everyone.
See you later.
Thanks again for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others. We loved getting your feedback, so please contact us on Twitter at AWS Podcast or via email awspodcast@amazon.com. Theme music provided under Creative Commons by Miles Rogers, audiofarm.org/audiofiles/22275.